Steve Haskin is joining us. Another Wednesday visit for Haskin. And so because it's a little bit, unusual to have Steve on a Wednesday, we're gonna reach into the mystery category for a conversation, Steve. And you may know what's coming if you were listening to me and Sid, but if you weren't, you don't.
Where did that come from?
It just sort of happened. It was part of a pedigree conversation, and I said, you know what? I'm bringing this up with Haskin. I'm sure he doesn't have anything in particular that, you know, the Arkansas Derby draw is Sunday. Well, next week we'll handicap Arkansas Derby, but I figured you didn't have anything, you know, really in mind. So I've got something for you that I know you're going to love.
What would you like to know?
Key to the Mint.
Key to the Mint. One of my, as a son of Graustark, he obviously was one of my favorites. And a half-brother to Fort Marcy. Who also was, well, he was one of my favorites other than the day he beat Damascus. Any other day, he was one of my favorites, but he wasn't one of my favorites that day. And he wasn't one of my favorites when he ran against Dr. Fager in the UN. But he just kept running and running. The thing is that Fort Marcy, you know, winds up, being a champion like 3 years apart. You know, he just kept running. He just kept getting better and better. And he was, you know, strictly a grass horse. But they were really high on Key to the Mint from the start. In fact, I just recently wrote a column about the 1971 showdown between the Battle of the Sexes between River Ridge and Number to Count, and he was in the race, and you know people don't realize that he had a heck of a rivalry with River Ridge. It was a strange rivalry because a lot of times one would win and the other wouldn't run well, so they didn't run 1-2 a lot on occasion, but they did run against each other 10 times, and River Ridge, I believe, won 6 out of the 10. But you know, I remember going to the track, the Aqueduct, to see the Key to the Mint in his career debut, because I was really looking forward to him. And you know, these are the days when we used to go down to the Rokeby Barn at Belmont and visit with Mike Kay, who was Elliot Birch's assistant. And you know, that's when, you know, it was Arts and Letters, and then it was Key to the Mint and Fort Marcy, and I mean, they had Summer Guest, and they had so many good horses back then. But I was really looking forward to his debut, and he was really bad. He was odds on in the race, and you know, everybody knew all about him. And he got beat in that race by River Ridge, who was coming off an atrocious career debut. But the thing about River Ridge is that he was a very timid horse, didn't like to be around horses, and he got bumped at the start, and he just chucked it. He just didn't run a lick. So they made Key to the Mint the heavy favorite in the race. And the two of them went head and head most of the way, and River Ridge wound up drawing away and beating him. You know, nobody knew at the time how good River Ridge was. But the thing about Keaton, you know, they were completely different. You know, River Ridge was sort of more of a gazelle-like, skinny type of horse, very plain-looking, lop ears. Keaton Mint was an absolute classic horse. He was like a Richard Stone Reeves painting. Just absolutely, absolutely gorgeous horse, and held himself very regally, had a lot of class. And he just, you know, he like I said, once in a while, he would disappoint. Like in the Preakness, even though he finished ahead of River Ridge, he was third. I remember there was another race where he ran against, when he was a 2-year-old, an allowance race, he actually ran against BBB.
Yep.
And he finished third to him, and they finished exact same order they would finish next year in the Preakness. But he got, you know, he got good later in the year, and he won. He actually, you know, he won an allowance race, and he won the Garden State Prep. That Garden State always had a prep race in the race. It was just an allowance race, but it was, they had the Gardenia Prep, and they had a Garden State Prep, and he, you know, he won that, which put him in the Garden State. But that was the time where, you know, it was all about River Ridge versus Number to Count. River Ridge was already established at that point as the, by far and away, the best two-year-old, and Number to Count was an absolute super horse. He probably had as good a two-year-old campaign as any filly I've ever seen. And, you know, Keita de Mint, he ran okay. I mean, he ran a decent third. Number to Count really should never have run in the race because she had run a week before, when she won the Gardenia, and they ran it back in a week, which was ludicrous. And River Ridge won, you know, won fairly easily. But River Ridge came back and he won the Remsen. And then I remember as a 3-year-old, you know, it took him a little while to get going. But you know, he wasn't ready for the Derby because he had just won the Derby trial. And then he won. Then he won an allowance race. Preakness always had a prep the week before called the Preakness Prep, which was just an allowance race that, remember, Bold Ruler had run in it. Bold Ruler actually had won it and then came back a week later and won the Preakness. But then the Preakness came up sloppy that year, and, of course, the River Ridge couldn't handle it, and BBB wound up just going to the front and stealing it. But I remember then, I remember going to the track to see Keita de Mint and the Withers, and he ran a tremendous race in there. Showed a lot of speed. He beat Ice Capade. Everybody remembers Ice Capade. Was an absolute brilliant horse. And then again, you know, disappointed in the Belmont. He didn't run well in the Belmont. River Ridge went off, won that race off by himself. But then he got really good. I mean, he really, really developed late in the year. And he started, Elliot Birch, who was never won to shy away from running 3-year-olds against older horses. He ran him in the Brooklyn Handicap, and he wound up, and he was a pretty good price in there. I don't remember what he was, but he was a pretty good price. And he wound up winning that race. You know, beat some really nice horses in a big field, and then he brought him to Saratoga, and they ran him against older horses again in the Whitney, and he won that one. Sure. You know, going to the lead, and I'm trying to think who would be it. I remember Loud was in that race.
Loud was third.
It was a pretty good race.
He beat Tunix.
Yeah, which is a Jerkins horse.
He had beaten Autobiography and West Coast Scout in the Brooklyn.
Right. Yeah, Autobiography would come back later in the year and absolutely trounce him in River Ridge in the Jockey Club Gold Cup when it was run at 2 miles, but. Yeah, then River Ridge came back and won the Travers. So, I mean, to win the Brooklyn, the Whitney, and the Travers. So, you know, as good as River Ridge had been, you know, winning 2 legs of the Triple Crown, you know, and River Ridge at that point had been basically ruined by Lucien Laurent and Penny Tweedy. Because after he won the Belmont Stakes, you know, 3 weeks later, he was in California. Well, but and back then, it was very rare to send a horse from the East to California. They sent him there for the Hollywood Derby, and he had to carry 129 pounds and just had to run his guts out in that race to win by a neck over some pretty good horses, including Bicker and another horse called Finalista. But he just was all out to win by a neck, giving away like 15, 20 pounds to some of these horses. And he really was never the same. And that race just absolutely gutted him. And then he had run into Monmouth Invitational after that, and supposedly he was drugged in that race. Penny Tweedy suspected, and everybody suspected it, and they actually ran, ran blood tests on him, and it came back with a tranquilizer, but it was after the race, and the traces were so minute that they really couldn't do anything about it, and nobody took any action. But, you know, River Ridge just ran a very, very dull race there. But anyway, that set up the battle for the championship in the Woodward, which was a mile and a half back then. And Elliot Birch, like I said, he always did strange things. And he wound up running Summer Guest, who was his big three-year-old filly that year. He ran Summer Guest in the Woodward. And Reaver Ridge just once again didn't run his race, and Keita de Mint wound up winning, and he beat Summer Guest, who wound up being disqualified. So then they had one final battle in the Jockey Club Gold Cup. But again, Reaver Ridge was not a 2 mile horse, even though they kept running him at 2 miles. It really wasn't even a mile and a half horse, even though he won the Belmont Stakes. It was one of those races where, you know, it was like American Pharoah's Belmont. He just went out there and set a slow pace, and you know, it wasn't the greatest field. He beat a nice Green Tree horse named Ruritania, who was another son of Graustark. But you know, he was a so-so horse, but he was a distance horse. But Reaver Ridge won that race because he just went out there basically and stole it. But he wasn't a mile and a half horse, and he wasn't a 2 mile horse. And Autobiography wound up absolutely destroying both of them. He won by 15 lengths. But you know, by winning the Woodward, Keita de Mint took the three-year-old title away from Reaver Ridge. And then they continued, you know, as the four-year-old. They ran the Brooklyn Handicap when Reaver Ridge set a world record. And again, Keita de Mint was the favorite in the race, but wound up fourth. He tried to run with Reaver Ridge early, and that was when they ran to Brooklyn a mile and 3/16, and Reaver Ridge wound up winning in a photo against True Knight, who was a Darby Dan horse who used to come from like 20 lengths out of it every race, and he was flying at the end of that race. There were some good horses that crop. Tentam was in that race, and Tentam was a very, very good horse. Wound up winning the Met Mile, and actually was second to. He wound up winning the UN on the grass, and He was second to Secretariat when he broke the course record in the Man of War. He was very versatile, really small black horse, but boy, could he run! And then Keita de Mint, like everything else in his career, he comes back in the Brooklyn Handicap and he goes to the front, opens up a gigantic lead in that race, and held off True Knight, who was flying again from way, way out of it. So he wound up winning that race. And then they met the big race. He met Reaver Ridge for the last time in the Marlboro Cup. And, of course, we all know what happened there. Reaver Ridge was second, and Keita de Mint just never, ever ran. And then Elliot Birch tried him on the grass, and he was up the track. He just went sour at the end of that year. Those last two races from Keita de Mint were terrible. But, you know, I mean, the UN was just a stab just to try and do something different with him. But he wasn't a grass horse, even though his brother was. But unfortunately, he ended his career, you know, with two poor efforts. But you know, on his best day, he could beat anybody. And like I said, that was an excellent, excellent crop of horses.
You know whose name didn't come up here as I'm looking at some charts. I got my racing manual out. Nola Hase.
Well, Nola Hase was he wasn't in the picture later on. Nola Hase.
No, but the first half of the year
during the classics, Nola Hase was he had a tremendous closing kick, and he would be in the Triple Crown races. You know, he'd be flying at the end of those races. And I think he had won the Arkansas Derby and the Louisiana Derby.
He absolutely, absolutely did for Homer Perdue.
Yeah. I remember, I think he was owned by Joe Strauss, if I remember correctly. I remember he had like orange silks.
You're unbelievable. J.R. Strauss. Absolutely.
Okay. There you go.
You're unbelievable. Who bred him?
I don't know. It wasn't Strauss?
No, it was the Knuckles brothers.
Oh, Knuckles brothers. Oh, really? Okay. But he had a tremendous closing kick. Early in his three-year-old year, he was closing in every race. He was a very good horse. But no, I mean it was really an excellent crop. You know, when you throw a Tentam in there and. And you know, it was unfortunate for Reaver Ridge that you know he just hit that Preakness. You know, it was just a sloppy, sloppy track that he just couldn't get hold of. But again, they kept making mistakes with River Ridge. But they finally realized he didn't like the slop, and that's why they scratched him from the Woodward and ran Secretariat, an unprepared Secretariat. Who you talk about bounces? By the way, you know, back then nobody knew what a bounce was. Can you imagine now having a horse that was sick and he missed the Travers? He was out for several months with a virus, and nobody knew if he was going to be able to come back and make the Marlboro Cup. So he comes back off a layoff. He not only wins the Marlboro Cup, but sets a world record in the race coming in. And then they run it back in 2 weeks. I can't even think what kind of a buyer he would have gotten in that Marlboro Cup. Let's say it was like a 127 or something like that. Or what his thoroughgraph number would have been, like a -5 or 6 or whatever. And then they run it back 2 weeks later with a mile and a half. Going from a mile. Penny was great, but she was so inexperienced. She was still green at the time, and Lucien Loring should have known better. Maybe asserted himself. I don't know whose decision it was, but they ran Secretariat and River Ridge in so many races that they shouldn't have. And then the thing is, after Secretariat gets beat by Prove Out in that Woodward Stakes, people don't realize, by the way, they said, oh, he got beat by Prove Out. Number one, do you realize that Prove Out was not in that race? And he wasn't supposed to run in that race. Because Prove Out had run 27 times in his career. He had run in one stakes race, the Chesapeake Handicap at Bowie, and was out of the money. All he had was like he had never won over a mile and a 16th in his life. And coming off the Chesapeake, Alan Jerkins decided to run him against Secretariat at a mile and a half, coming off a mile and a 16th race at Bowie. And he had worked with him, and he had always liked him, but he just kept working with the horse. The horse had so many problems. He would log in all the time, and Jerkins just kept giving him all kinds of inhalers and nasal stuff and dandelions. And, I mean, he just... And he kept changing his bit, and he put run-out bits the opposite way. He did everything he could possibly do with that horse. And I remember in the Marlboro Cup, you know, I mean, Secretariat looked like he was going to, you know, in the Woodward. You know, nobody knew about bounces back then. Everybody figured, all right, Secretariat going a mile and a half again at Belmont after what he had done the first time. So I remember being out in the back at Belmont that day, and they showed the Marlboro Cup on the TV monitors in the back by the pond. And who's watching it there but Alan Jerkins and Jack Dreyfuss are watching the race. So I'm standing next to them watching it. And I remember after the race was over, after Secretary had won, Alan Jerkins turned to Jack Dreyfuss and says, what the hell are we doing in this race anyway? You know, which is very typical of Alan Jerkins. And then he goes out, and you know, the track was off, and you know, Secretary is on lead, and Prove Out takes back off the lead and sits off him, and then at the quarter pole just goes right by him on the inside, and he draws off and wins by like 4.5 lengths. And people don't realize, by the way, that had Alan Jerkins not run Prove Out in that race, everybody said, what a bad race Secretariat ran. Coming back 2 weeks off a world record, okay, if Prove Out is not in the race, Secretariat wins that race by 11 lengths and runs the second fastest mile and a half in the history of Belmont, second only to himself. He finished 11 lengths ahead of Cougar. So, I mean, Prove Out beat two Hall of Famers in that race. And he ran a mile and a half and 2:25.4. That was the second fastest mile and a half to Secretariat. So Secretariat would have won that race by 11 lengths in the second fastest mile and a half. And it would have been like, oh, Secretariat is just like the greatest. So what did they do? Because originally Secretariat was supposed to run in the Man of War. So they run him in this race. So if he gets beat, what does Lucien Loring do? He puts him in the Man of War anyway, which was like, it was like a week or 10 days later. And Secretariat breaks the course record, going a mile and a half there. So he sets a world record at a mile and eighth. Then he runs the Woodward Stakes. They runs in the Woodward Stakes and runs second in the second fastest mile and a half in the history of Belmont. And then he sets a course record going a mile and a half in the Man of War Stakes in the span of 23 days. I mean, people always look at Secretariat, you know, in his Triple Crown. But, I mean, you know, then Proveout went on and went in the Jockey Club Gold Cup where Alan Jerkins worked him a full mile and a half and then blew him out in a race by giving him a two-mile, two-minute lick, at the end of which he worked a half a mile in 47. Alan Jerkins had that horse so fit. And then he goes 2 miles, runs Weaver Ridge into the ground, running some of the fastest fractions in the history of the two-mile Gold Cup. Was, you know, I mean, fractions were like 2-3 seconds faster than in Kelso's record. And so what does Proveout do is that he lugs in, he bounces off the rail at the quarter pole when Loud comes in. Loud had run the Travers and had run second to Shuby in the 2 mile Gold Cup, the distance horse. And Proveout just runs off and wins the race by almost 5 lengths, comes home the last quarter in 24 and change. And runs the second fastest 2 miles behind Kelso. I mean, people don't realize that Proveout at the end there was unbeatable. There was no horse that was ever going to be. He had that horse so revved up because he had greatness in him. He just had so many problems. That's why King Ranch got rid of him. But like I said, it was just unfortunate. It's just too bad. You know, Key to the Mint didn't. Didn't retain his form. He other than that time at Saratoga, when he won the Brooklyn and the Whitney and the Travers, he never really put two or three really, really good races together. But on his best day, he was a brilliant horse. He liked to run, you know, right on the lead or just off the lead. And, you know, he loved a mile and a half when he beat, when he beat Weaver Ridge. But he was a very good horse.
When he beat
River Ridge in the Woodward to secure the 3-0 championship, that track was off too. I forgot it was sloppy or muddy, but
they called it sloppy.
Yeah, it was sort of a fast sloppy track. You know, it wasn't like soup or anything like that. It was sort of a drying out type of sloppy track. But again, he didn't want to go a mile and a half. He didn't want to go in a slop. So they ran him. They ran him in that race. They ran him in that race anyway. But they made. And the thing is, I spoke to Penny Tweedy after that. She admitted it. She admitted that they screwed up Weaver Ridge. He should have had a much better record. But that's a rivalry people don't really know about. They ran against each other 10 times. So it was great. It was a great year, 1972. You know, everybody, and then of course Secretariat was the horse of the year as a 2-year-old that year. You know, Kid and Mint would have been horse of the year that year, obviously, if he didn't get trounced by Autobiography.
Well,
and
he's still
number two, by the way. Frank Martin was at his height at then. I mean, yeah, he had, you know, obviously he was, you know, he wound up with Sam, and he had so many good horses, and he was just really. Really becoming an elite trainer. He started off, he had upset the Suburban Handicap with a German bred horse named Hitchcock. But he had some really good horses. Remember, he took a Darby Dan Castoff, who was another grouse dog named Prince Dantan, and sent him out to California, won the San Diego Handicap with him. Pancho Martin was really one of the top trainers in the country at that point. But he had Autobiography. He had him really primed, and Autobiography just loved the 2 miles, and the other two really, really didn't love it.
It's unbelievable. I mean, there's so much in here, and you hit on a few. Nola Hase is going to capture my interest, with my horses, the Time Forgot series that I want to do. And speaking of,
I'll tell you another horse, by the way, that people don't talk about. There was a horse that year. Here's another horse, by the way. People don't realize this. Everybody talks about Weaver Ridge and everything. And, he did help save, Meadow Stud and everything like that. You want to talk about maybe the most forgotten horse ever that same year. But Meadow Stable had another horse that year named Uppercase. And all he did was win the Florida Derby and the Wood Memorial. And everybody's forgotten about him, like he just, like he never existed. So Meadow Stable had two really good horses. And early in the year, I mean, they really weren't sure who was actually more of a classic horse. I mean, River Ridge was obviously was the 2-year-old champion and was more brilliant. But you know, he had gotten beat early in the year in the slop, of course. And they wound up running him in the Everglades. But Uppercase, when he won the Florida Derby, and then he comes back and wins the Wood Memorial, and everybody thinks, wow. But I think he got hurt after that. And he never did anything after that. But there was another horse that year that won the Flamingo, which was the big race in Florida that year. He won by 10 lengths. And sometimes you see him in pedigrees, too. His name was Hold Your Peace.
Sure.
Who was a very good horse. And he won the Flamingo that year by 10. So when you look at Uppercase, who everybody's forgotten about, nobody remembers Hold Your Peace. Nobody remembers Nola Hasse. These were really, really good horses.
Yeah, and there's some
person. And another horse, by the way, another horse that people have forgotten was a horse that he won 3 major stakes. And when he wasn't winning stakes, he'd finish up the track. He was the most inconsistent horse you've ever seen. He was owned by Middletown Stables. His name was Freetex. And Freetex was in that Garden State Stakes, too. He actually was the horse that was flying at the end of that race. He wound up second in that race. But he's the one that won the Mammoth Invitational, which is now the Haskell, when Reaver Ridge supposedly was drugged. He wound up winning the Ohio Derby. He won several really big races back then. He was, again, a company behind horse. But there were some races where he'd just run around the track and do nothing. But some races, you just never knew when he would pop up and run a huge race. And he had started off at the old Liberty Bell Park. He had won, you know, some of their small stakes as a two-year-old. But, you know, on his best day, he was a pretty good horse, too. He just didn't have many of his best days. I mean, you know, the more you think of it, the more I keep thinking of some of these good horses that year. And there were some really, really good horses. The Whiteleys had a horse for Penny Brin that year named Cloudy Dawn, who was also a good horse. But I believe was third. I think he was third in Reaver's Belmont. But he had run in the Mammoth Invitational too, and he was a closer. He was he ran in the Bel Air Silks, really big, strong, dark, almost black horse. Really really nice horse. But then Ruritania was a green tree. Like I said, Graustark, really well bred horse who ran second in Reaver's Belmont. Got another horse that year who's good at the end of the year, won a bunch of stakes at the end of the year that William Hagen Perry had named Forage, who another strikingly beautiful horse who wound up winning races, like I said, late in the year, like the Romer or Discovery, those kind of races. But he was always right there at the end of the year. I mean, there's a lot of good horses. That's a year that people don't even think of, because all they think of was, oh, yeah, Secretariat was the horse of the year. Reaveridge won the Derby and the Belmont Stakes, and then we had Secretary the next year. But it was fascinating following those horses through Florida. And like I said, all those Florida horses really weren't around, because that's when Reaver Ridge started asserting himself and Keaton Mint started getting really good. So I'm trying to think. I think that's about all I can remember about Keaton.
That's the idea. I mean, there's so much here, and that's going to trigger some other conversations. And I this Nola Hasse and happened to be brother of Soy Numero Uno.
And let me tell you something also, by the way. Soy Numero Uno was I don't know if it was the first or second crop of Damascus.
Yep.
And I remember he won his first start by like 7 lengths or so. Brilliantly fast horse. never really turned into what they thought he would. But he was one of the first really, really fast. And the funny thing is that Damascus produced all of these precocious two-year-olds that would come out and win first time out. And Dr. Fager produced all the horses that got good later in the year and would go on and wait until they were two-turn horses. He never produced any really, you know, precocious horses with Dilly Precious. But she was even better scratching out. Nola Hase was a very, very fast horse. Soy Numero Uno was a very fast horse. Opposite of Nola Hase, who was a comes-behind horse.
Well, and I'm also discovering, I'd seen the name, but I don't know much at all, and I just reached out to Dale Romans, Homer Pardue, who trained them, and
he was all veteran by then.
Had a tremendous career, born across the street from Churchill and Hot Walker, and became an exercise rider, had a cup. You know, not only did he win the Louisiana Derby and the Arkansas Derby with Nola Hase, he did it a second time. he did it a second time with a horse that got hurt and didn't make the Derby, as it happens. A few years later, Clever Tell in 1977.
Oh, Clever Tell. Clever Tell was a very good horse. Clevertel was an excellent horse. He actually turned out to be a really good. Ran some huge races.
He won the Futurity at two.
Later in the year,
and won the Futurity as a two-year-old.
Yeah, but he turned out. He ran some huge races. He was running in the Midwest, and ran some big races. I think he might have finished second in the Travers.
And that would have been 77. So that 77?
77 or is it 70? I thought he was was it 77? I can't remember what year he had run a big race in the summer. But he won a bunch of races. You know, maybe in the Midwest, like maybe the American Derby or those kind of races. But he was nice. He was a good horse. He turned into a very good horse.
Now we're going to.
Homer Pardue was like, you know, like I said, he was. You know, when he had Nola Hase, he was a veteran already at that time.
Well, we're gonna talk. I reached out to Dale Romans and I said, "Who do you know that can tell us about Homer Pardue?" And he said, "Tammy's dad, Bill Fox." He said, "Bill knew him really well." So we're gonna slip this in. I mean, there's so much.
Right? Homer Pardue.
It's a great name. It's a tremendous name. Absolutely.
I mean, if anybody ever sounds like a Kentucky hard boot, it's Homer Pardue.
I love it. I love it. Well, Steve, this was perfect.
I guess we both. I've been writing diversion columns,
and they're great. They're terrific.
You know, so just how people escape. You know, I just did a 30 question trivia quiz that like nobody got anything. It was so obscure, but I didn't make them. I didn't make the questions for people to actually try and guess it. Because, you know, the thing is, if you ask normal questions, people automatically run to Google, you know, which is not, you know, what's the fun in that? But these were questions that everybody said, oh, I didn't know. It was 30 questions, and most people didn't get more than two or three right. But the purpose of it was to supply the answers to make them really, really interesting, like things you didn't know about racing. I mean, I could have written them as interesting facts, but I put it in question form. But it was just kind of obscure things that people could not look up on Google.
I love it. I saw the headline, and I haven't had a chance to look at that yet. I love it. That's great.
Yeah. One of the questions that nobody got was, who was the first horse to go off as the favorite in all three Triple Crown races and win none of them? And it's a horse that nobody would even know. But I remember following that Triple Crown. It was a horse called My Dad George.
And what year? I was going to say it's not that long ago, that it wasn't his.
It was the year where he was the favorite in the Derby. You know, that Dust Commander won, and then he was the favorite in the Preakness. That Personality won, and then he was the favorite. But he ran well, and well enough to be favored in the Belmont, and that High Echelon won.
That's right.
Which gave actually, Hearst Jacobs just died earlier that year, so he was actually responsible. But John Jacobs, who was a listed trainer, became one of the few trainers in history to win two legs of the Triple Crown with two different horses because he trained Personality and High Echelon.
Nice.
But that was that year, Dust Commander won the Derby that year. Ran it very impressively. He won off by himself. And he had won the Bluegrass Stakes at 35-1. And he was like, before Charismatic won the Kentucky Derby, he was the last horse before Charismatic to win the Kentucky Derby who had previously run in a claiming race. The only difference is Charismatic had run for 62.5.
That's right.
And a Dust Commander ran for 7,500. he won the Derby like it. He probably made like 25 starts or so. But he popped up out of nowhere in the Bluegrass Stakes, just out of nowhere, and won very impressively. And then came back and won. And after winning at 35-1, he comes back in the and wins the Kentucky Derby again. And that started the whole. I'm not going to call it a dynasty yet, but it was that whole, you know, the Robert Lehman and Verna Lehman, you know, from there came Run Dusty Run and Bob's Dusty and Master Derby and all those horses. But it was just to throw this in, I don't know where we came up with him, but one of the funniest things was that, you know, nobody knew how to react because nobody knew who Robert Lehman was. And he accepted the trophy, the Derby. And, you know, the Kentucky Hard Boots, when you go up there, you know, you're supposed to be humble. Oh, this is the greatest moment of my life. This is the moment I've been waiting for. Robert Lehman gets up there, and they interview him after the race. And they asked him, so what does it feel like to win the Kentucky Derby? And he said, oh, it was good. He says, you know, he says, it's not as good as big game hunting, though. not only does he degrade the Kentucky Derby, but now everybody knows that he goes out and kills animals in
God.
Africa.
Good.
You know, nowadays, if he said that, he'd be lynched.
That's true.
But winning the Derby was not as satisfying as. And then later on, he wound up explaining because then. When he had Run Dusty Run and Master Derby, those horses he bred, and he says he couldn't get any satisfaction from Dust Commander because he didn't breed the horse, and he wound up having a big beautiful farm in Kentucky, and you know who they bred, John Henry came who's bred that farm.
How about that?
So I mean they bred some really good horses. And you know, all through the 70s, you know, Master Derby, you know, was running. You know, he'd run big races, and was running against Forgo, and you know, won a whole bunch of big races, and won the Preakness. Run Dusty Run, of course, would have been a tremendous horse if he didn't run and come along the same year as Seattle Slough, and wound up running second to Seattle Slough in two of the three legs of the Triple Crown, and then finished second in the won the Travers, and got disqualified. People forget about Run Dusty Run. He was a good horse. They put up a horse called Jatsky, who was a Midwest horse. And so that was kind of a strange Derby. because Seattle Slew was already gone. You know, he had gotten sick, and you know, after that California debacle, so Run Dusty Run was left finally without Seattle Slew, and he finally was able to win and wins the Travis, and they get disqualified.
Exactly.
But I'll never forget Robert Lehman swearing big game hunting. You know, it's like he got more satisfaction for shooting an elephant than winning the Kentucky Derby.
Well, there's really only one unsatisfied Derby winner, the Derby winning owner we can think of subsequently. That's a rare occurrence.
He was happy for a few minutes.
No, I don't know. All right, so that means a third. I wasn't even thinking about Gary West.
Okay.
I was thinking about somebody else that was snarling 30 seconds after he won after he'd won a Kentucky Derby.
Yes,
Steve,
well, he did not know quite how to handle that, because he said he got snubbed. Nobody, myself included, nobody would even bother talking to him. Nobody came. Nobody said, "Who the hell is that? Who wants to talk to that guy?"
Steve, this was tremendous, and I appreciate it. And we'll be looking forward to Derby talk next week. Of course, it'll be the Arkansas Derby.
Hey, it's the Kentucky Derby. I don't care if it's run in Arkansas. This is, especially if they split it, and they're going to get a lot of good horses. If they can split that race, it's going to be like. To me, like going to Ebbets Field as a kid for a doubleheader.
Doubleheader. Well, over there, though, you might see if it was going to be a day-night, be a separate admission derby.
Yeah, no, back then they didn't have that. Now they do that to rook all the fans over there.
What's his name?
$90 to go see a game anyway, but, you know,
It was Yawkey. It was Tom Yawkey who thought that up, that split the day-night doubleheader for separate admissions.
Really? Tom Yawkey? That's far back?
I'm almost positive. You look that up, I think Tom Yawkey created that.
God, I remember my first doubleheader. It was the Brooklyn Dodgers at Ebbets Field against the Braves. And I remember Joe Adcock hit 3 home runs.
Wow.
It was the second game I ever went to in my life, and it was a doubleheader. And I remember we were sitting upstairs behind third base, and every time I looked down, Joe Adcock was rounding third. I became a Joe Adcock fan actually after that. But, God, I loved doubleheaders, Yankee Stadium doubleheaders. And, you know, game is over, you just sit there, have some hot dogs, and wait, and then wait for the players to come back on again. You know, they were great. They were fantastic. But you remember the famous quote from Ernie Banks, right?
Let's play two.
Yeah, let's play two. I mean, it's perfect.
My dad told me about a doubleheader at Ebbets, where I think Preacher Rowe. I think.
Oh my God, that's really going back.
I think Preacher Rowe. I think my father said one of the first games, maybe the first game he ever saw, and it was a doubleheader. And Preacher Rowe threw, I think he said a one hitter, if I'm not mistaken. I'll have to look that up. Preacher Rowe, how about that?
Preacher Rowe, that's a hell of a pitcher.
Well, that's when. My father's 90, 91. Yeah. So.
Yeah. But
Steve,
I mean, listen, that's the way I look at the Arkansas Derby. It's gonna be like a doubleheader.
It's gonna be great.
And you realize, by the way, which I should wish you a very happy Erif draft day.
Thank you. You too. Best of luck. Thursday night?
Yeah, tomorrow night.
Oh my
God!
The question is: do the
Eagles go with an offensive lineman, or they go with one of those speedy Henry Ruggs, or one of those faster wideouts? They need a wide receiver, but they also need, they lost Jason Peters, so they need an offensive lineman, and there's some really good ones this year. So it'll be interesting. It's going to be one of the two. They got to pick either an offensive, either a tackle or one of those. I mean, there were so many good wide receivers this year. I mean,
that's what they say. It's a great class. Yeah.
Oh, there's so many good ones. Remember the name Michael Pittman, by the way, from Southern Cal.
This guy, look at you.
He'll probably go second round if nobody snags him. But this guy's going to be great.
I'm glad you reminded me.
Days of the year.
Yeah, it's always it's going to be weird. It's going to be a little different, right?
Roger Goodell's going to be doing it from his basement.
That's pretty funny.
All 32 teams are all set up in their dens, in their basements with TV screens and monitors.
Unbelievable.
A bit of a glitch, you know, and you can't you get your pick in time.
I'm sure they'll be fairly liberal on that part of it. Who knows? Maybe the thing will be.
It's going to be great. It's a great draft here. I mean, it's so fascinating. Who's going to do what? I mean, I can't wait.
No, it should be good. Steve, let me get Seth Merrow in here. I got 15 to say hi to Seth, and this was really fun. And I see that people are loving Key to the Mint. And I just got a picture of Nola Hase, a color picture from Leslie Knopf. She was there as a schoolgirl.
Orange silks. Has he got his orange silks?
Yes, sir. Absolutely. You hit it. You
I remember.
100% right. Yeah. Unbelievable. Was sort of like a star on it. Stars on the sleeves. Yeah. I'll put it up. I'm going to put it up on. I got.
Oh, good.
Stuff.
I look forward to seeing it. I haven't seen Nola Hase's picture in probably 40 years.
It's coming your way as we speak. Steve Haskin, everybody, we're going to stay right here because Seth Merrow is standing by. And rather than eat up 3 minutes with a break, and since actually top of the hour, we played our exit music anyway. So perfect. And here's a chance to get Seth in here, talk a little Tampa and whatever else. I mentioned that, you know, Seth has been sending out daily his handicapping missives. Good morning.
Good morning. We started the week a little early. I've been doing mostly Wednesday through Sunday, but I started a little early to get into Fonner yesterday with the pick five mandatory and a couple of second picks for me and a couple of winners and then that 35-1 shot, which, I had written in my comments that was what I thought was the toughest race in the sequence.
No doubt.
And you look at that horse, and it was playable. I'm not red boarding. I didn't have it. It would have been a tough push for me, but it was one of the horses you could have made the argument for in a tough race that if you were going a lot thinner, like I say, a couple of the winners were top picks for me, and I'm sure they were for other people too, maybe a single in one or two of those, and that was the toughest race. You could have included that horse. I mean, it wasn't one of those 35-1. I think it was 12-1 on the morning line.
It wasn't
one of those 35-1 shots that you looked at and said, oh, where'd this horse come from? I mean, it was tough. It was a tough push, but there was enough there class-wise, and there were some races underneath that were okay, so it was usable. And it was one of those that, again, had that horse that lost by a nose got up, I would have been happier. A lot more people would have been happier. But given the money that was put in the pool, I think a lot of people walked away with $14,000. So good for them.
Well, and there's 100 tickets, 100 plus tickets out there that, you know, they come back, and that's nice to get that kind of money into circulation, especially, you know, under these circumstances. And you're not saying anything out of school. Let's Go Places was a crazy win price, given that, I mean, any sheet player, Let's Go Places was faster than Shady Lane, who was 4-1. So, on Thoroughgraph, I absolutely. Now, you have to eat and you have to swallow a very, very low percentage connections. And
that was there was more not to like than to like. But as they say, if you were going deeper, you could have made the case.
Well, and one of the – listen, yesterday we said, with Nick Tamara, we said, you know, if you can afford to hit the all button, then this was the place. And I'm sure that some people did it that way because, as you reference, you did have – Frankie Doro at 3-2 and Magnanimous at 6-5, and the two of them you could have really leaned on, and so you could have spread in the more you know, in the more tricky spots, the first leg and the fourth leg. It was very approachable, and when you handicapped it, you could feel that, and that it was absolutely worth playing. And even if you, you know, even if you struck out, got knocked out in the first, you know, you had that terrible Dazzle Man, ended up with traffic, probably, you know, was in the midst of a winning rally. You know, that's part of it. And the adjustment, Seth, that everybody's, I brought it up again with Chris Katulak this morning. Everybody that plays bigger racetracks and A circuits and even the B circuits, they're all learning and you know, seeing the visuals on a 5/8 racetrack. There's very few. I mean, some of the fair racing at, you know, places like that, that are, you know, 5/8 ovals. It's new to a lot of us.
It is crazy to look 6-furlong race. They're starting from the top of the stretch. Mile race, they're going 3 turns. It is, you do have to adjust a little bit and kind of figure things out. I said, though, you know, a few weeks ago when we were talking about some of these smaller tracks, I over the years have handicapped a number of them for OTV TV and whatnot. And I like them because, as I said then, if you get out of your comfort zone a little bit, I think it helps your handicapping. I think you have to kind of refresh your handicapping thoughts a little bit, and especially in a smaller track like that, you have to modify a little bit as well. So I think it helps the handicapping a little bit. As I say, get out of the comfort zone occasionally.
Well, Tampa, though, that is your wheelhouse, and I didn't expect to print out races 5 through 8, but I got to tell you, the more I looked this morning, I realized this is a really good sequence, and I know that I saw that early this morning or late last night you circulated your analysis. Let's give everybody some insight to the late pick 4 at Tampa today.
We'll do it. I just want to go back to race 4, though, because I will say races 2 and 4 are off the turf. The others are on so far. I just did check the scratches a few, though. Race 4 is off the turf, but I'm going to stick with my top pick there, 20-1 Louis Backyard. Tommy Proctor, second-time starter. I'm just going to take a little roll of the dice here because there's a little bit of breeding. It's interesting. That horse with the fun name, Queen Latifah, this is a sibling to that one. That horse won a couple of weeks ago sprinting on the dirt.
Won on Thursday. Thursday.
Yeah, it was just recently.
Thursday.
And so this one, I like the switch to the mile on the grass, but again, we're getting some class relief in the second start, and with the sibling having won the debut on the dirt. This one, if you watch the first race, just seemed to be out for a ride. So a little bit of a price. I just wanted to toss that out there in the fourth, Louis Backyard. But moving on to that late pick 4, fifth race kicks it off. Optional claimers going 6.5. I have a 2-6-4-1, and in the pick 4, I'll go 2 deep and use the 2 and the 6. The 2 is Shug, who in the career debut looked pretty good at Gulfstream in February, tossed in a solid buyer number. The follow-up just was a little bit of a head-scratcher. You know, had the trouble lines as agitated, so I guess we'll give an excuse there. But then he come cross-state to try lesser optional claimers. You get back to that career debut. It looks like the one to beat. But Legacy Azteca, had to throw that one in. Bennett Camacho seems to be in good form. They claimed the horse a couple of back and tried this company last time and ran an okay third. So I'll throw that one in the mix as well. So again, I have a 2-6-4-1, but on the pick 4, I'm going to use the 2 and the 6. Moving on to the sixth race. $10,000 open claimers. And again, this one, as of now anyway, still on the turf. I have it 4-7-1-8. I'm going to use the 4-7-1. Crown of Joy on top. I think the horse will benefit from the seasonal debut. Had been up in the Northeast most of the latter portion of last year. Monmouth, the Meadowlands, Turf Meet, and then came down to Gulfstream Park West in November. Laid off from that November start until towards the end of March. Comeback wasn't much, but again, it just looks like one to maybe prime this horse to get the season started. It was against a little bit better, so a little class relief Gallardo on board. We use Crown of Joy on top. Antalya in the second spot has again been racing again, like the top pick, against 16 claimers, but a little more consistently over the past few starts. And it's been kind of competitive, so it gets a little half step of class relief that I think will be beneficial. And Durbin, tried this kind of company at Gulfstream back in November, has Gulfstream Park West, hasn't been seen since then. Tried a couple of state-bred stakes races at Colonial before that, and then the four and five starts back at Gulfstream last summer. Those were okay against maybe a little bit better. So, again, this is a horse making the seasonal debut, but I thought there was a little bit of class here, a little bit of back class that just was made the horse a little too hard to ignore, and Santino jumps on board. So we'll go three deep in the second leg. Again, I have it 4, 7, 1, and 8, but on the pick four, I'm going to use the 4, 7, and 1.
Should all, you know, should mention not an MTO, but the six. Let me see those other three. Did they all come out? The six, the 12. Looks like the 12 is running.
Yes, you're absolutely right. 6, 11, and 13 are out.
Okay.
In race number seventh race, third leg. Maiden specials going 7 furlongs. It's a fun race because Shug brings the first are over by honor code. They paid $650,000 for this horse at Keeneland, September 2018. Honor Code, obviously that's notable. Okay with the win early types. The dam produced a couple of siblings, one called All Go, another one named Sweet Legacy. Both of those took a couple of starts to win, and that's maybe a concern that maybe this horse would need a start. Because, again, the two siblings, one of them ran fifth in the debut and then won. One of them ran eighth in the debut and then put in a couple of subsequent wins. But the Chug ships over for a 20,000 maiden special purse to Tampa, I think, means this one will be well met in the debut. So I'll put Creed on top. Go ahead.
7/8. When Shug debuts him at 7/8, he's telling you that by all rights the horse needs longer. Shug has had a fairly notable some of his better horses over the years that were going to be two turn types, they debuted at 7/8 and successfully in a lot of cases. This happens to be aspiring was by Seeking the Gold. So I mean there's nothing but long windedness in here in Creed. Hasn't really lit up the board in the mornings at all. I mean I don't see a fast work, and I only see the couple of spotty gate works. I kind of like to see a gate work with a little bit of speed, and I don't know. I think
and like they say, two siblings took a start to figure it out. But I just found it interesting that he's going over for a $20,000 purse to Tampa. That kind of stuck out to me that there, and I don't know what's in the book, over in Gulfstream. At 7 furlongs, because maybe that's exactly what he wanted. But I'm going to go three deep in here regardless. So I also have Sense of Justice for Mike Stidham. They paid $350 for this horse. Hasn't quite lived up to it yet. But the debut was at Parks last July. The comebacker was April 1st, so may benefit from that move forward. Blame the Cake, interesting. This is a New York bred. Debuted at Saratoga for Ian Wilkes. The debut effort was pretty good. Just missed there. The follow-up, not so good. But this is a horse they bought at Ocala last April. And I always like it when those, two-year-old sale runners come back in the summertime and try to validate what they showed at the sale. This horse was 9.4 at the sale last year. So I'm going to look for this one to maybe come back as an improved three-year-old. So, again, I have that seventh race, 5, 6, 7, and 2, but I'll use the 5, 6, and 7.
A couple of quick notes too in here. I mentioned early this morning, Seth, when I said you'd be on and we'd look at this sequence, the 4, Holy Cross, Ian Hemingway, and he has won this winter with a couple of second time starters. And this horse ran evenly in the debut. And I would not be surprised to see Holy Cross, jump forward in here. And then there's also on the outside, I wanted to mention the second time starter from Michael Tomlinson, who is Captain Billy Roy, a cowboy cal that's a half to the very nice Jordan's Henny that Tomlinson trained for the Woolly and Kinder, the breeders. So there's a lot going on in that seventh. Give us the eighth.
Yeah, it's a fun race, seventh race. Eighth race, optional claimers, non-winners of one. And you may be able to tell me this. I have an 8, 5, 6, and 4. I'm going to use all four of those in here. I have the 8 on top, Summer Assault. This horse, debut was very good, won in the debut, then tried the dirt, still ran a good second, tried Stakes Company on the grass last time, going longer, and ran third. But that good debut was sprinting on the turf, so I don't think the cutback is going to be any kind of an obstacle. So Summer Assault on top. But in the second spot, I have Uncle Bud. I'm curious why they're dropping this one in for the tag, because on the conditions, I think the horse could go under the non-winners of one other than. I mean, I looked up the conditions, and it wasn't in the book. It was in the added overnight races. But I think the horse could run for the allowance conditions, so that they're kind of dangling the horse for the tag.
Gotcha. Yeah. I understand. You're running out of racetrack here.
Okay. River Hawk, also coming out of a stakes try. And Clippy, you won for me last time. I just have to look for that one to improve on the second start. So 8, 5, 6, and 4. And again, I'll use all four of those.
I just retweeted Seth's sheet from today. Thanks to Chris Katulak, Pete Fornatel, Sid, Steve, and Seth. Talk to you in the morning.